Hi, welcome to Salvage Yard. Hey, how's it going? We have new people and new haircuts. This is fun. I haven't seen it yet. Yes. John got a haircut. Welcome. I don't have any other announcements. Does anyone else have any? We'll pass a hubcap around for offering. That's kind of an announcement, Noah. Yep, there you go. Cool. Well, we don't have any announcements and still passing around the hubcap. Excellent. Well, without further ado, I'm also doing announcements and I'm doing a sermon, so multitasking today. So I have a short, brief story. Josh and I yesterday went to Hard Times for pancakes and huevos rancheros, which is not necessarily an important part of the story, but it was really tasty. And so we went there, and when we got out to our car, we got in the car and saw a note on the windshield, which is never a good thing, because it either means someone, like, hit your car, or it means that they're angry at you for something. Once I got a note from someone, like a scathing note about how I parked in front of their house, and they're very upset about it. So they wrote me a note on the back of their grocery list, and it was very strange. So I was like, oh, what is this note going to be about? And we read it, and it was our next door neighbor, like, brushed our car by accident. So the guy who owns the Angry Catfish, so he's a nice guy. So we didn't want to, like, you know, bug him about it too much. But he left, like, all of his insurance information and was like, hey, like, I'm so sorry this happened. You know, I'm going to make it right, whatever. And we were, like, super grateful because if you know anything about the last, like, 2 years of our car history, our last car got hit 8 times in the same location and only one person ever got caught. And they actually, like, got caught doing it. So this is, like, first of all, amazing that someone left a note. So we're kind of processing what to do about this. Like we have every right to call our insurance company because there's a decent scratch on it. But at the same time, we're like, dude, does it really matter? Like to us, we kind of finally decided, you know what, it really doesn't matter. Maybe we'll get a cup of free coffee and that can be the retribution or whatever. But if we decided to, like, I don't think our insurance company or society or anything would be like, you guys are jerks. Like, I can't believe you called his insurance company. Like that's within our legal right to do that. But we decided not to. We gave him a small amount of grace in that. And the story tonight is about a small amount of grace times, like, about 10,000. It's actually a very big amount of grace. So hopefully some of those parallels will go through. So we're in Holy Week, and we're probably going to be in Holy Week for a couple of months. So a holy quarter, maybe, of the year. And right now we're kind of at the spot where Jesus has entered into Jerusalem. There's the triumphant entry with that kind of ragtag procession. He spent the better part of a day flipping over tables and upsetting people at the temple, like driving everyone out of this, like, multi-acre complex. And so clearly last week he got, you know, a talking to, by basically the religious leaders. Actually, they have kind of like three branches of religious government, the scribes, the chief priests, and the elders. All of them showed up to talk to Jesus and question his authority. We talked about that last week of, like, who gave you the right to do this? And Jesus responds with a question and then basically responds with, well, I'm not going to tell you who gave me this authority. And so that was part one of the conversation. Tonight we have part two of the conversation, actually. Jesus continues and almost answers their question with this parable. And this parable is cool. It's got, like, this kind of combo platter going on of this prophetic warning to the people, but then this awesome, like, revelation of God's character in the midst of this warning. So we're in Luke 20. 9 through 19, and it goes like this. He went on to tell the people, and the people here are the chief, all the, like, religious leaders, and also a crowd of people. So he goes to tell them this parable. A man planted a vineyard, rented it to some farmers, and went away for a long time. At harvest time, he sent a servant to the tenants, so they would give him some of the fruit of the vineyard. But the tenants beat him and sent him away empty-handed. So the owner sent another servant, but That one they also beat and treated shamefully and sent away empty-handed. So he sent a third, and they wounded him and threw him out. So they rejected him socially as well. So the owner of the vineyard said, then what should I do? I'm stuck here. He thinks about it for a while and says, all right, I'm going to send my son, whom I love. Perhaps they will respect him. But when the tenants saw him, they talked the matter over. This is the heir, they said. Let's kill him, and then the inheritance will be ours. So they threw him out of the vineyard and killed him. What then will the owner of the vineyard do to them? He will come and he will kill those tenants and give the vineyard to others. When the people heard this, they said, God forbid. Jesus looked directly at them and said, this is the meaning of which is written. Or then what is the meaning of that which is written? The stone the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. Everyone who falls on that stone will be broken to pieces, and anyone on whom it falls will be crushed. The teachers of the law and the chief priests looked for a way to arrest him immediately because they knew he had spoken this parable against them. But they were afraid of the people, because people liked him. All right, let's pray. So this is a lot here. Jesus, I pray that we would really start to grasp what you meant by this passage, that we would see parts of your character that are either new to us or that are totally old hat, but we need to hear again in fresh new ways. God, you're the only God that can show us those new things and reveal new things to us. So we need you to do that. So thanks. Thanks for being here with us, God. Amen. You probably can't tell, but I'm wearing my Cornerstone shirt from Cornerstone 2002 because it talks about the Cornerstone. Anyways, that's why I'm wearing like a ridiculous old shirt from 2002. All right, so this is sometimes we have parables that are like super complex and we really don't understand what's going on and it like takes a lot of unpacking. Or we have parables where the crowd just kind of like blankly stares at Jesus and they're like, I don't really get what you're trying to say. And then he has to explain it and it's awkward. But here, this is the parable that clearly gets the point across right away to the listeners. They don't have to dig around for an interpretation. Because all throughout the Old Testament, especially in Isaiah, whenever they talk about a vineyard, that is the nation of Israel. So when they hear vineyard, immediately they're like, yep, that's us. And then when they hear about the people who are supposed to take care of the vineyard, they're like, yep, it's the religious leaders. So that's kind of where some of that strong response comes from, because immediately it's like, oh, shoot, that's us. And the messengers in this one are the prophets. They get that too. And then the son, of course, is Jesus. They're kind of, maybe they didn't realize that. Maybe they heard him say that and that's why they got super upset. Because that becomes very clear in this passage. And I think it's pretty clear to see why this doesn't sit well with the temple leaders. He's basically completely calling them out and saying that this whole institution is going to get destroyed. You are no longer going to be in charge of this thing. So we'll get into that part a little bit later. But this type of setup with this kind of absentee landlord thing is pretty normal. In fact, it's a pretty cool situation if you can get the job, because normally there's a lot of people who are migrant farmers, or they would work for a season, and then who knows if you're going to get a job next year. But these guys had it made because they pretty much like, hey, you're just going to live on this farm for like an indefinite amount of time. All you have to do is pay a portion of the grapes or whatever. Grapes aren't a vineyard. Grapes. To the owner. That's your rent, basically. So if it's a fruitful year, you give a certain percentage or a fixed amount, whatever. That's all they need to do to live there. So they should be really grateful because this is a sweet deal. It's like a 10-year, like, guaranteed rent. Rent stays low. You're not going to get kicked out of your apartment type of place. But these guys are evil. Like, I read through it for a while, and I was like, this seriously feels like it's some sort of, like, Tolkien story or, like, some, like, evil, like, Game of Thrones kind of thing. Because, I couldn't even, like, fathom the amount of evilness that's going on in these renters of this vineyard. It was creepy. They basically were acting like they were the owners of the place. Like, if you think about it, like, if you're renting somewhere and, like, well, pretend it's Jen. So if Jen is talking to John and John's like, hey, rent's due, and she's like, I'm not paying it, and, like, walks away, they're basically saying, like, you don't have any control over this. I own this place. I don't know if she does that. I like to think she does. Who knows? Who knows? Who knows? But that's what's going on here. Like, the messengers keep coming, and they're like, we're not paying you. In fact, we're going to beat you. Don't do that to John. I don't know if you could. Who knows? Who knows? But in this situation, and in our situation, too, like, there'd be some legal rights to then, like, kick the tenants out. So if Jen did that, there's housing court, there's lease stuff. Like, you could call the police if Jen's trying to attack John, that kind of thing. Similar here, like he could have and probably in their society should have gone and tried to kick these tenants out. That would not be outside of the realm of possibility. He has a right to retaliate and defend his honor. But instead, he does like this super weird thing and sends another messenger. And another messenger. And this is the same thing that God did with the Israelites. Time after time after time after time, God keeps sending prophets to call Israel back to him, to be a fruitful vineyard. And they keep rejecting and ignoring and killing these prophets. It's really depressing to read about the prophets because they just, every time, Israel just ignores them. But God is still patient with them. So in this story, we're at a place where the owner is just out of options. He's got to be angry. He's got to be frustrated. He's got to be thinking about, like, should I retaliate? What should I do? He's probably hurt because he probably knows these messengers. Yet somewhere in the midst of that, he chooses a different option. One that doesn't use his anger and destroy the tenants, but chooses something that is much more full of grace. And that is that he will send his son. And it seems a little weird to me, like before I thought through all of it, like why would you choose to send him? Like you could have chose to send an army and get your money back. But man, this is what it says his reasoning was. If they didn't listen to the messengers, then maybe they'll listen to my son. Maybe they'll notice he has authority. Maybe they will notice that I'm being vulnerable here. I actually care. I actually will forgive them, and maybe they'll realize how awful they're being. Maybe that will shock them into a new way of life. And so he goes with that plan of action. And here Jesus is saying that that is also God's plan of action, and it's being currently planned out. Like to me, this is weird. Like, Jesus is telling them a story, like a parable of something that is currently going on and also will happen in the future. Like, he's saying, like, I'm going to die, by the way. This is playing out in real time, and you're in this story. Like, they must have been listening so intently here. Like, they had to have been. So in the meantime, in the story, I'm sure at some point, like, the tenants are probably sitting here waiting for retribution. Like, okay, we killed the first three messengers. Like something big is coming. Or maybe nothing is coming. That would work well, too. But instead of getting, like, an army full of people to destroy them, they get this, like, unarmed son of the owner instead. And unfortunately, it doesn't shock them into changing. It doesn't change their hearts. Because they see him, and I'm thinking this is probably the case. They probably assumed that the owner had died. Like the owner could have came. But the son is here now, and so we know how it works. Like, we have the owner, and the owner dies, then the son gets the vineyard as an inheritance. So all we got to do is wipe out the son, and then the inheritance floats around, and they had legally they had squatter's rights. So if you lived there for 3 years, you like actually got it. It was a thing. So for them, like, this is kind of a sweet deal. Like, we just got to get rid of this guy and we get this whole vineyard for ourselves. Like the depth of sin is just intense here. And so they kill the son, and it bites them in real ways. They are completely and utterly destroyed. Like there's a consequence for sin in this story. And so none of the listeners are really stoked about this story, like any of them, really. The people who are listening, the crowd who is really excited about Jesus, they're like, God forbid, because they're horrified, because Jesus says he's going to die here. And they don't want him to die. Remember, they wanted like the big Messiah thing, who's going to come in and like take charge and like overthrow the Romans and everything. Like, now Jesus is saying that he's going to die, and that's not part of their plan. So they're upset about that. They're upset because he said that the temple leaders are going to have a hand in this, and they're the ones that they trusted. And then you got the religious leaders who are super upset because basically he's saying, hey, this vineyard that you've been entrusted with, you're not doing a good job, and you're going to lose that vineyard. It's going to be given to others. So people don't take this well. It's helpful when you hear sometimes that, like, people don't take Jesus well because, I don't know, as a people pleaser, sometimes I'm like, I want everyone to like me. They didn't like Jesus. So sometimes you're on the right track. But in this story, Jesus responds to them with this weird quote from Psalm 118, which is cool because that's the very psalm that they used to announce that Jesus was coming in the triumphal entry. They're like, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. And in that same psalm is this line, the stone the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. And he also quotes from Isaiah, everyone who falls on that stone will be broken to pieces, and everyone on whom it falls will be crushed. Now, the last part I kind of had a little bit of a hard time with. It sounds kind of strange. I heard it explained, though, as this rabbinic proverb that says this. If the stone falls on the pot, like a clay pot, woe to the pot, because it crumbles. If the pot falls on the stone, woe to the pot. Also, so basically in a war between a stone and a clay pot, the pot always wins. I thought about this too the stone always wins. There we go. I thought about this too in the story of like my foot versus the coffee table. Like if the coffee table hits my foot, woe to my foot. If my foot hits the coffee table, woe to my foot. So either way. No, either way, it hurts. Either way, a war against the stone is pointless. And Jesus is saying here, either way, a war against me is pointless. Like, you don't want to get into that. That's not why I'm here. I'm here to save. I'm here to love. It only leads to your own destruction. So then he brings up this cornerstone thing. What once was the throwaway stone is now the foundation. This is going to get a little architectural here. But back in the day, like if you're super rich, you built houses out of bricks. If you were medium rich, you would build houses out of stone. And so you would find like four super big stones that were kind of even, that weren't cracked, and they would be the cornerstones of your house. You put one in every corner. And then you would actually fill in the gaps between those with other rocks. So as you fill it in, there starts to be more and more pressure. So you want rocks that are really stable at the corners because you don't want them like slipping because then your house falls. And if you're in a house full of stone that ends up falling on you, that's a problem. So you'd find ones that were really good and the builders would go through and they would find the rocks that like wouldn't make the cut and they would just like kind of reject those ones. Like that one's got a crack in it. Nope. Now it's made of whatever sandstone. We don't want that for the cornerstone. They would throw ones aside that weren't going to be useful. But Jesus uses that same analogy here, that the stone that was once thrown away, that was useful, that we knew was not going to work, like, that is now going to be the foundation of this thing. The one that the builders rejected, the person, Jesus, is now going to be the foundation of this whole new thing. And this is actually a verse that is used quite a bit in the New Testament. It's used in Acts, it's used in 1 Peter. It's something that the early church like clung to. Like Jesus is the foundation of us. He is the cornerstone. And that maybe won over some of the crowd. Definitely did not win over the religious leaders because they were like, dude, if he's the foundation, like we don't like this guy. We don't want this, you know, weirdo being the foundation of this thing. We gotta get rid of this guy. And it even says that this is when they start plotting of how they can get rid of him. And I think what is sad to me in the midst of this is there's this amazing, beautiful picture of God's character in this parable. And people get mad because there's a lot of like our religious system's going to get overthrown. But it's cool to me because there's still this picture of God's grace and God's patience that I think might have been missed the first time they heard it. And one of the clues that there is something important going on here is that Luke gives us kind of a hint in here. Remember when we went through and we made that like word pyramid thing? on the thing. You guys weren't here. We made a word pyramid because sometimes when Luke goes through and says, like, hey, this thing is really important, it's at the middle of the story. Like, we think, like, the end of the story is the important part. Like, here it would be the judgment. Like, the judgment's the most important part of the story. Actually, in this story, it's like the middle part is the most important part. And the middle of the story is when God says, what am I going to do? I'm going to send my son. And so when we preach here at the Salvage Art, a lot of times we ask ourselves this question, what does this passage tell us about God's character? What does this passage say about God? And I think that this parable actually speaks volumes about who God is, which is cool because in turn, that is what changes us when we have a revelation of God's character. So first of all, this passage, I think, speaks overwhelmingly of God's extreme patience. Again, over and over and over and over in the Old Testament, he kept sending prophets to call people back to him, and he rejected them, but God loved them so much that he kept sending these people and trying to get the Israelites back. In the whole book of Luke, I think it's so cool, I don't like the Pharisees, they bother me, but at the same time, Jesus continually, like, gives them a door that they can walk through of like you guys, I know you disagree with me, but if you would come alongside me, like, you can be a part of this kingdom. Even though they're, like, obnoxious and they give him a hard time, like, he still invites them into the kingdom. He still has patience. He still wants everyone to come in. And even thinking about my own life, like, there's so many times where God is so patient. Like, I cannot tell you how many times I've came to him with, like, the same thing over and over again. And, like, seriously, you would expect God to be like, dude, like, we've been over this. You've got to stop, or you have to start, or whatever. But he still forgives. He still pursues. He still has patience for me. And in that patience, he turns his anger into grace. So just like in yesterday morning when we would have every right to call the insurance company and it's not really retaliate, but, you know, it's a little bit of like make things right by getting our car fixed. Just like how we had that right to do that, the landowner in the story had every right to retaliate. But in the story, he decides to stop that. He decides to do everything he can to stop the need to retaliate. And we have a God who does the same thing. There's this cultural term. I've been reading this, like, nerdy book still. It's The Jesus Through Middle Eastern Eyes. It's super cool still. So he's talking about in the Middle East, there's this Greek word called macrothymia, which sounds like a disease, but it's not. And that basically describes a person who has... I'm sorry, you've been diagnosed with macrothymia, which would be a good thing because this is a person who has every right to avenge and retaliate, but they choose to restrain themselves. Like, literally, this word means to put anger far, far away. I wish we had a word for that in our language. We have things like patient and forgiving and risk-taking and compassionate and noble. But I feel like that word, macrothymia, that, like, you have every right to retaliate, but you choose not to. Like, that is at the core of who God is. And that, to me, that's, like, the summary of this passage. Macrothymia. And there's, like, the Bible's littered with stories like this. I was reading a few of them to kind of prepare. There's a story in the Old Testament where David's being hunted by Saul, and then Saul goes to use the bathroom in a cave. And David goes, and he's like, I could totally kill him right now. In fact, his friends were like, you should totally kill him right now. But, and he should. He has every right to, but he chooses restraint. And because of that, Saul sees that and recognizes him as the future king. Or a few months ago, we talked about the story where there's that wealthy man who wants to throw a banquet, and then people keep, like, RSVPing no to the banquet. And he gets really upset about that. But in turn, instead of retaliating, instead of being anger, he turns that anger into grace and goes and invites the sick and the lame and the people who are rejected in society. Like, that's who our God is. And if you look at the world, if you even look at your own life, maybe you would see that God has every right to be angry. Like, some of the stuff that I've done, some of the stuff I've seen people do, like God, seems like he would have the right to retaliate in a lot of these situations. And the story does tell of a time when God will make things right. He is the God of justice, but he's also a patient God. He is a macrothymia God who turns that anger into grace. But that grace isn't cheap, as we see in this story. It requires him to give up his son. And I think that in this story, he probably knew that it was a possibility that the son could get killed. But there's this chance also that maybe this would bring his people back to him. And that means that it is worth it. As I mentioned, Jesus drives home a lot of things in this parable that people react to. He tells them that he is part of the prophets. He's in the line of prophets. He reveals that he's God's son. He reveals that he will die. Because the story is, yeah, it's a parable, but it's also talking about Jesus. And Jesus also reveals that it is worth it to him. Because maybe, just maybe, people's hearts will change when they see Jesus. And maybe, just maybe, that will change the world. Maybe that will change people back in the story that he's actually talking to. Maybe that will change people in our lives. There's a story I'm going to close with that I really think describes this concept, really describes who God is, his character, in this macrothymia type of way. It's in this book. It's about the king of Jordan. It's a true story. Historical story from the 80s, so it's not super history. We're all from the 80s, unless there's kids that are not from the 80s. It's like... Really? Okay, this story doesn't apply to you. Just kidding, it does. Okay, it says this. One night in the early 80s, the king of Jordan... There's a beeping that's happening. Oh, okay, good. One night in the early 80s... My hair's in my face. The king was informed by his security police that a group of about 75 Jordanian army officers were at that very moment meeting in a nearby barracks plotting a military overthrow of his kingdom. The security officers requested permission to surround the barracks and arrest the plotters. After a somber pause, the king refused and said, "Bring me a small helicopter." As you would. "I will send my son. Bring me a small helicopter." A helicopter was brought. A king climbed in it with a pilot and himself flew to the barracks and landed on its flat roof. The king told the pilot, "If you hear gunshots, fly away at once without me." So unarmed, the king then walked down two flights of stairs and suddenly appeared in the room where the plotters were meeting and quietly said to them, "Gentlemen, it has come to my attention that you are meeting here tonight to finalize your plans to overthrow the government, take over the country, and install a military dictator. If you do this, the army will break apart and the country will be plunged into a civil war. Tens of thousands of innocent people will die. There's no need for this. Here I am. Kill me and proceed. That way, only one man will have to die." After a moment of stunned silence, the rebels, as one, rushed forward to kiss the king's hand and feet and pledge loyalty to him for life. Like, that's a true story. And that is who God is. He's the one that's willing to come and the willing to be vulnerable and die for us because he knows that it's worth it. Some people might still not get it. Some people might still reject it. But that's the God who we see in this story, and that's a God that's real with us today. So let's pray. God, we thank you that you are like this. We don't deserve it at all. But God, you turn your anger into grace over and over and over again. It's who you are. We deserve one thing, but you're patient and loving and give us something completely different. And so we thank you for that. And I pray that this whole idea will change who we are, and that we will be different people because of this revelation of your character in our lives. In your name, amen.